Tonight, we present the third program in our new series on politics and the imagination. Freelance broadcaster David Keeble guides us through the labyrinth of the so-called underground press.
I think we're the only publication in this part of the country that young people believe that they can sit down and read and they can say, no, those people are trying to get to the truth. They do not trust the Daily Press at all. There's no doubt about that.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. And the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. 7 little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
We've got the bomb. They have a right to their opinions, but I despise those opinions. So said Tom Paxton, author and singer of the Daily News. Paxton is by no means alone in his belief. Dissatisfaction with the politics and style of the mass media is a North American tradition and is common to both right and left. That dissatisfaction has found a new outlet in recent years in the development of an alternative, sometimes underground, press. Its growth has been rapid and widespread, to the point where no city of any size is without at least one existing underground paper and a history of others that failed. It's hard to tell how many there are in North America at any given time, but a conservative estimate would be 300, with a total circulation of 2 million. There are also several well-established underground news services that function as an exchange for stories and information among some of the papers. In short, while the underground is still a fringe phenomenon, it represents a substantial number of people looking for a different means of communication. If a single reason were needed for the growth of the alternative media, Nick Fillmore's comment, "They do not trust the Daily Press," would serve. But in fact, that mistrust has expressed itself in a number of different fields. The underground started with the development of what was then called a hip community in North American cities, and dealt largely in its early years with art, music, and poetry. It expanded enormously in size and scope with the so-called hippie boom, and concentrated on the substance and events of the Cultural Revolution. Some papers still retain the style that was popular at that time, but two new elements have entered the picture since then to form the focus for the newer parts of the alternative media. The first of these is an attempt on the part of the papers to expand their constituency, to attempt to relate to the entire community in their city and deal with its real problems in a responsive way. The second element is a left political orientation, varying between propaganda and an attempt to relate analysis to the community. These three elements do not constitute pure types, as most papers combine them in some way, but it is possible to identify most papers as leaning towards one or the other. These differences in no way overshadow the overall differences between the alternative and the straight press, however. The underground has some universal features that set it apart, not the least of which is working conditions. The magazine Avant-Garde said in a recent article, "It stands to reason that if Spiro Agnew can spit on the New York Times and the Washington Post while thousands cheer, then Klansmen, unscrupulous DAs, and other creeps can gang-rape the underground press while millions cheer. All over the country, as a matter of fact, the youngsters who staff underground newspapers are being arrested, their cars are being set afire, their offices are being bombed, burglarized, or riddled with bullets." Police harassment of the underground appeared to be less widespread in Canada than in the States, but the proclamation of the War Measures Act brought a rash of seizures and arrests in its wake. In addition, some of the older papers, such as Logos in Montreal, Harbinger in Toronto, and the Georgia Strait in Vancouver, have had a history of hard times. That and other features will be examined by tonight's program, which contains interviews with a selection of Canadian papers: Gorilla in Toronto, Octopus in Ottawa, the Fourth Estate in Halifax, Yellow Journal in Vancouver, and the nationally distributed Last Post from Montreal. Doug Austin is a writer for Gorilla in Toronto. It is a relatively new paper, with less than a dozen issues to date, and like most of the newer papers, it concentrates on political change.
The paper is meant to undermine the sort of safe complacency that the middle class in Toronto have about their city and about how things operate. I wasn't in on the original naming. I joined the first issue, wrote for the first issue a few days beforehand. This paper was started up by a co-op, a bunch of people living together in a house up on Bathurst, and they formed the editorial collective and advertised for people to come in and give them a hand. And the way the paper is run, we have one meeting every 2 weeks, and anyone who has a beef airs it. Our present policy is to leave it as open as possible. Let the individual writers make up their own minds on what they think is right and wrong about such and such. So far, it's been largely a sounding board for the community, I feel. Here in Toronto, you know, for so long there's been a growing discontent with very little dialogue. Now we're getting, in our pages, we get all kinds of dialogue. We get a guy like John the Bear writing an article last issue about there ain't going to be no revolution. And then this issue, a couple of letters come in, one for and one against that article, plus an article by Jan against, you know. And we're getting a real dialogue. We would like to get into corporate dealings and wheelings and dealings much more than we have, but this takes time and research, and until we get to the point where we can pay people a living wage so that they can devote their full time and energy, say a month, to a story on Coca-Cola or on Eaton's, we won't be getting that kind of story right away, that's for sure. But that's definitely where we're aimed. That's one facet, and the other facet, of course, is to be a community aid, meaning we run a lot of free ads for people like the Hall and communes and anybody we think's doing a good thing, like Red, White, and Black, the American Dodgers and Deserters Society, things like that. We had a meeting in here last week with a bunch of papers. Harbinger wasn't there, but there was Varsity, Eye Opener, ourselves, the Just Society's paper. The idea being to get to pool our information, to get some sort of information pool going on news stories and things like that. Like if they wanted to know something about Coke and one of our boys was doing a story, they could phone up here and get the statistics. None of us are very strong believers in copyrights. We think you should take a story from another paper if it looks interesting, put it in, say where you got it, that's all. You know. To me, we're all in this together, you know. I hate to see the new left fragmented and splitting up, which is the case. You get, you know, you get ego trippers and they form a clique, and they can't agree because of some written law that they've put down or something with some other segment and so forth. I'd like to get away from this, and I'd like everybody to become aware of the fact that we're all up against it, you know. The dilemma, of course, is that the community itself doesn't have that much money. The people who like to read the sort of things that we put out are in the same position we are, in that they don't want to take jobs in which they have to lie and things like that. Therefore, they don't have that much money. We're trying to get around this dilemma by going after advertising, which in itself creates a dilemma. We don't want to advertise people that are obvious rip-off artists, you know. But we threshed it out and decided, well, we do want to survive. We do want the word around. Therefore, we're going to have to go to the rip-offers and rip them off as much as we can, you know. I think that's the point we got down to now, is that we're going to take advertising no matter where it comes from. But we are not going to put lines of our limitations upon our writers. If we take an ad from Eaton's 1 week, and the same week a writer comes in with a story on Eaton's that is derogatory, we'll put the story in. You know, we may not get the Eaton's account again, but the hell with it. That's not the whole point of the thing.
The point of the thing for Guerrilla is to provide their community with an organ of communication and self-identification. In the center of a large city where the physical environment alone may disrupt the possibility of community relationships, and where the large dailies project an image of the community that is both distorted and exploitative, an alternative medium is an aid to survival. The need for such a medium accounts for the appearance of Guerrilla, the Toronto Newspaper, and the Toronto Citizen, to name some even newer arrivals, and also accounts for the gradual change in an older paper, Octopus, of Ottawa, which started life as the Canadian Free Press 3 years ago. We spoke with Mike Bloom, who has worked on the paper for some time, and Henry Milner, who arrived more recently, about the paper's change from its earlier style.
In about December 66, I guess it was, people got together to start a paper because they felt that there should be one. Remember, this was sort of at the beginning of the whole hippie kind of thing. This is when things were happening and people were becoming increasingly radicalized. So Tony Seed was with Les Schramm and a few other people got together and started a paper, and they put out an issue January 67. They put out the first issue. They printed it probably, I think it was 4,000. It was the first Canadian underground paper done. It was earlier than the Strait or any other one, and it was quite famous. It was being sold all over the place, in the United States, all over the place, because people were very hungry for this kind of paper. But at the beginning, it was kind of primitive, and there was poetry in it, and there was a lot of things about metaphysical kind of things, and all this general sphere of writing. It's very difficult to classify these papers, because the people writing them, for one thing, aren't people that you can classify easily. They're unusual people. But what I meant was, some papers are designed to be orientated towards entertaining you, and talking about entertainment, the industry of entertainment, eh? Now, Rolling Stone was into that. They've been, mind you, lately, they've been doing some non-entertainment kind of things, but generally they were talking about rock stars and that whole thing. There have been a lot of people trying to emulate Rolling Stone. That's what I mean by a music paper, and talking about the latest dope bus and who's brought in the most dope and that whole kind of thing. It's one kind of paper. And these people are people who are trying to escape from the reality of the political situation in the United States and Canada, and they just want to have a good time. They're the same kind of people who have big cars and drink beer and go to football parties. The same kind of people, except into a different thing, but the same attitude. Now, then there are the people who are genuinely concerned with the political situation. And to those people buy my other kind of papers, the kind of papers that, like Last Post, like the Los Angeles Free Press, and the Berkeley Tribe, and the East Village Other, which are... do have occasionally articles about rock or dope, but are principally concerned with what is happening politically and culturally and socially in the United States, and are not escapist papers in the sense that they're trying to make people forget about what's happening. They're concerned. And the people buying these papers, I find, are usually older. In Ottawa, they're older. They're usually less fake people. They're usually people who are just more worried about what's going on. And luckily, I think luckily, there are more of those people than the music people.
In terms of relating to the community of Ottawa, one of the things to do, of course, is to discover what the community of Ottawa is. It's not a simple thing to discover. We've discovered. Ottawa is very much of a very quiet civil servant town, and things are very much kept below a certain level of noise, and you don't hear very much that happens. We have contact, we have had writing, and we're aware of the activities of many of the local tenant association, community associations. We have people in the various unions that are corresponding with us, and a few of them that are writing for us. With student groups, we're both University of Ottawa and Carleton and some high school group, people are communicating with us. We're sort of acting as their voice outside of their university or high school. There's some ties perhaps with left New Democrats, waffle types, who have things to say which are relevant here, but can't publish elsewhere. And even every once in a while you get a dissident journalist who knows something and can't publish it. Those are the kinds of things. And then finally, of course, there's a whole culture out here, what's called a free culture. I like to call a non-establishment, but maybe perhaps that's not the right word. But anyway, we're talking about people who live in a way that the so-called regular society doesn't approve of, who work on somewhat different ethical standards, and who in fact have to fight to defend their way of life. They have no spokesman, they have no one to communicate their thoughts and to help them to publicize their plight. In that sense, though, that's our direct constituency. And I think, well, but then again, that's always been our constituency. I just think we've widened in terms of the community. But I don't think that's a sufficient answer. I wish we were more on top of what was happening in Ottawa.
I've sold now 11,000 papers on that corner of my career, which is a lot of papers, because you have to say papers, would you like to buy a paper, about 40 times to sell one. So you can see I've said it about 500,000 times. I've gotten everything from people saying, fucking communist kind of thing, you know, which they say occasionally, to casual disgust, bitter, hostile looks, people jabbing me in the side, people saying, degenerate, weirdo, and get your hair cut and I'll buy a paper, and you look like an octopus, and no thank you, I've already eaten, and I've got one at home in my bathtub, and no, I'll have a squid though, and all those kind of things, you know. Hundreds, I've heard them all. But people, they're always humorous. The most common line, if they're trying to be funny and get away with not buying paper, is, I can't read. And I say, well, some of us can, some of us can. But there are a lot of straights buying them. I was surprised. Before I started selling them, I figured it was long-haired people and that kind of people who were going to buy papers. And it isn't. It is, to a great extent, people who are straight, who are trying to find out. And I think that's a good thing, because those are the people I really want to have see the papers. As far as I'm concerned, now a radical in Berkeley may want to get his people together, you know, so that they can unite in a mass and burn down a place. That's one thing. As far as we're concerned, we want the other people to see what we're thinking. So when a guy in a business suit buys that paper, I say, great, he's going to read that paper and he's going to see what we're thinking, which you wouldn't otherwise. Whereas the guy's walking on the street in grubby bell-bottoms and stuff, he knows to a great extent what we're thinking, and he's pretty receptive anyways. It's the man in the business suit we want to hit.
And a newspaper isn't the kind of thing that one can talk about as having a goal. I mean, the goal is that the newspaper does better what it's doing. My hope in a political sense is that if some kind of movement in Canada, in Ottawa or in Canada or anywhere, develops a movement that I would consider to be meaningfully socialist or meaningfully a kind of a political alternative to the establishment that runs our country or runs our world, and that's our world at all levels, from neighborhood up. That in fact we are the kind of a medium that will help this kind of thing to spread at its early stages and later. That if there's, you know, if there are political happenings that are important, from a rent strike to the setting up of a daycare center to the setting up of a new political party to a very large, important protest demonstration. But any of these things and you know, the development of such a thing requires a voice, requires a mirror. And that's the kind of thing we hope to be able to serve, so that We can't bring that about. I mean, we're not a political device that begins political change or that initiates political change. But I think we can contribute to it, and the hope is to create the kind of thing that will be as good an instrument for this purpose as possible.
There's a reason why I sell the Underground. Obviously, I'm not selling Time magazine. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for that. It's because I believe in what I'm doing. I wouldn't do it. I could make money other ways.
Sure.
If I wanted to, for that matter, I could push dope and make more money. I could make a lot more money. I've known guys who make more money in one day than I've made selling papers, period, in my whole career. But the Underground is performing a useful function. It's a good thing as far as I'm concerned. We're trying to break even. We've never made a profit on that, which usually be because we get ripped off for quite a lot of money. We distribute it to people on the street at a cost of at a price of 15 cents per copy. Now they don't pay when they take them out. Mm-hmm. They pay when they sell the papers. We have a policy: if we don't know a person, we'll give them up to 25 papers. And he takes the 25, and if he sells all of them, fine. He pays us $3.75. If not, he pays us 15 cents per copy and returns whatever he doesn't. That way, he can't lose any money. And you know, because most people who sell Underground papers don't have any money to start with. That's why they sell in the papers. So we could hardly ask them to pay for them.
One thing that the Underground Press has always tried to do is to talk about the integration of, what would you call it, theory and practice, in the sense that there's very little use in calling for a different kind of society, a participatory or democratic or socialist, whatever word you will. One that is non-hierarchical, one that is non-exploitative, if you've got a newspaper which is built on the on those principles that you're trying to eradicate in the society, if you have a newspaper where there's a very definite hierarchy, where the lower people make no decisions but are just treated as means rather than as people, there's a danger of that once you become big and bureaucratic and money-making of doing that. And it's a danger that you know, it has to be avoided. Not that there's much chance of our becoming big and money-making for a while. But I think once you lose sight of that, once you lose sight that you have to integrate those two, and that your own reality has to point toward the direction of what you're trying to do in what you say in the paper, at that point, when you stop doing that, you stop being an underground paper, no matter what your content is. Because you can't create the same kind of fervor. You can't talk about the same kinds of things with any meaning. Perhaps underground papers have to be struggling, and they have to be in constant flux, and there have to be a lot of people working together, not really knowing where they're working, in order for them to really be underground papers.
Into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked and you say, who is that man? You try so hard but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home, because something is happening here but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
The difference in attitude between Bob Dylan's song, Ballad of a Thin Man, and Mike Bloom's statement, It's the Man in the Business Suit We Want to Hit, indicates the change that the underground has experienced since the cliquish days of the hip and the unhip. But it's not by any means a reversal of position, rather an attempt to find a balance. Henry Milner expressed a general feeling when he said there was a danger in becoming successful. You get cut off from the street, tied down to the so-called professional standards of production, time, and money. It's commonly said that the Georgia Strait in Vancouver has lost its touch since it started to rely on money rather than personal zeal and commitment. But that does not imply a total rejection of professionalism. There are many journalists with experience in the Strait Press now working in the underground. Their professionalism results in an even sharper commitment to the goals of the alternative media. Nick Fillmore and Brenda Large of Halifax's Fourth Estate are such journalists. Their paper is less diffuse than either Gorilla or Octopus, and its ability to deal factually with the realities of power is a distinguishing characteristic of the more political underground papers.
We really see the Fourth Estate as something useful to change our community. We don't see our newspaper as a mirror that reflects the community back to itself. We see grasping issues, trying to pick them up and carry them and show people where they're wrong and how things can change and improve. We really don't know how much impact we have on the community at this time. We're only a year and a half old. There are signs that action will follow when we say something. We've carried out some kinds of campaigns, for instance, in the slum housing area. We've carried out a fairly number of articles that we've written on slum housing, and we've been told by people in the real estate business and tenants and so on, the Tenants Association, that many people have sold their slum properties, partly because of the Fourth Estate, partly because of the work of the Tenants Association. And because of this, we feel that we are getting response to the kinds of things we're doing. We've zeroed in on some individuals and their activities in the community, and get the kind of feedback that, okay, this guy better watch it, or else his seniors will then have to do something to him. There's a possibility that involving two, well, if you want to call them government scandals in regard to the developments at the Housing Commission, there's a possibility that stories carried in the Fourth Estate possibly meant that the minister in charge of the Housing Act was displaced from his job. There were other factors involved. You never can tell completely, you know. The other area, it involves another cabinet minister who had quite a serious drinking record, And we carried, at that time we were doing Barnyard Fables, in which we imagined this imaginary character, and we did this thing. And lo and behold, within a month, the guy had lost his position in the government. We're not quite sure at this point how much actual power, if you want to call it that, the Fourth Estate has. Power shows weakness in the social structures around you to some degree if you develop a power in such a short period of time. It indicates that there is something wrong with the community around you. If people really, you know, if you come out, you're only a year and a half old or something, and you come out and you rap this and you rap that and so on, and if people really are listening, man, look, there's something damn wrong in that community, and we think this is showing up. As far as dealing with power and how you look at it, I think it's quite important that we build a wide base at the bottom of it. And by that I mean that when we express our opinion on something, I want to make damn sure that it's well researched and that the facts are there and that we have some basis for what we say. Now at the top of this, somebody has to be the little god. Somebody has to decide what is right and what is wrong for the community. But you have to leave yourself open to enough feedback from the community that if you do get off the track, you can backtrack, and you are responsive to the community. There's a good possibility the Fourth Estate will make some money someday. I'm going to be goddamn sure that money is going to go right back into that paper, or the most of it, and I hope that I'm a strong enough person to make sure that the general direction of the Fourth Estate does not become too conservative and too wishy-washy, so that we stop working at the social things that as far as I'm personally committed to work at. I said it the first, and I still say it, and you can't even start compromising at all with yourself. If it does change, and if other influences mean that the paper has to become safe and has to make money, which I can't imagine, I'll go elsewhere and I'll do something else. If we got into a big lawsuit and the Fourth Estate were lost, maybe I could go to, Peterborough, Kingston, Hamilton, somewhere else, and work in some other kind of paper that I felt was working in the direction of solving people's problems. I don't feel that society in Canada is a good place to live for many people, and I think there are lots of things that can be done, and journalism is one hell of a good way to work against these things.
One of the things about our contributors that I always think is so important is their tremendous enthusiasm for the kind of thing that we're trying to do. These are people who are committed to trying to change the community the best way they know how, and they see us as a vehicle for getting alternative ideas to the public. And most of our contributors work for free because they believe in what we're trying to do.
It's quite interesting to see the reaction of other journalists when they come down and visit the Fourth Estate and have a look at what we're doing. As a matter of fact, just last week there was a writer in from Associated Press in Washington who's doing a large feature on Nova Scotia, and he was really amazed to find a little publication like this starting up in Halifax, and he really wished that he could dump the whole thing in Washington and come work for a small paper like ours. Other journalists from across the country, we get the same kind of reaction. Gee, you people are really doing something you can feel and something you want yourselves. So this is how we kind of value what we're doing as well.
One of the interesting things that has been brought out by the hearings held by the Senate Mass Media Committee has been the great difference in attitudes between the people who run the daily newspapers, for instance, and the reporters who are out covering the stories. The reporters tend to be more radical, more concerned about all kinds of social issues, whereas the people in control are relatively out of touch, concerned with business, concerned with advertising, and with status in the community. I have yet to meet a reporter who I respected who didn't really wish that he could be in an operation like ours.
I think the great myth about Canadian journalism today is this business about objectivity. This was shoved down my throat when I was at Canadian Press. I remember doing political roundups for CP. You had to make sure, covering the federal election, that Trudeau and Stanfield always came out nice and fair in the stories, and that everything was equal, and so on and so on. Papers in Canada, especially the Daily Press and the wire services, Canadian Press, has been hiding behind this idea of objectivity and evading the real issue that newspapers, I think, should be aimed at, is making the community aware of itself and changing itself continually.
We've been doing a lot of thinking about this business of objectivity and whether there really is any objective news report, and we don't think there is, of course. But the European newspapers have always had a tradition of interpretive journalism, personal journalism, with the reader knows the writer, he knows his political views, and he bases his opinion of a report on that. One of the great European newspapers, perhaps one of the greatest newspapers in the world, Le Monde, is very much this way. And I don't think there's very much understanding in Canada yet of how important a force of an interpretive paper can be.
Nick Fillmore and Brenda Large, by virtue of their experience, see the differences between the alternative and established media very clearly. These differences are very important to the underground, as it is the failure of the straight press that is their reason for being. At the same time, some writers on the dailies are very conscious of what is happening in the more political alternate media. The result is a strange relationship, basically antagonistic, but colored with some respect. We have attempted to depict that relationship by excerpts from a series of interviews with members of both camps.
The newspaper, in a sense, provides the news that tells them where they are, that identifies the community to them and reminds them what the community in which they're living is. That is that's the function of a local paper. That is, people who... there's no reason that people should read the Ottawa Citizen and Journal if they can read the Montreal Star, the Globe and Mail, the New York Times. There's absolutely no useful stuff in the worthwhile, objectively worthwhile stuff in either of the Ottawa established papers in that sense. And yet almost everybody, and that includes even people who disagree fundamentally with the whole position of the Citizen Journal, they still nevertheless subscribe, because the newspaper provides that identity with what's happening in the community, and they need that, so that if there's a strike, or for some other reason the newspapers stop publication, there's a real sense of loss. And our feeling is that the Citizen and the Journal are good examples of two newspapers which don't really fulfill that function, although they provide people's need for that identity is provided for by the Citizen and Journal. But not, I don't think, in a meaningful sense. That is, I don't think the feeling of what Ottawa is like, or the meaning of the Ottawa community, is really given in the Citizen and Journal. I think there's a very distorted picture, one in which the realities of power, of who makes decisions, the realities of what life is like if one is not one of those members of the powerful, those realities are left out.
There was tremendous resentment, and still is a certain amount of resentment in the community against the local daily press, and this was also a factor, we believe, in the success of the Fourth Estate and its predecessor, the People. People in the community had felt that the local papers, the Halifax Chronicle Herald and the Mail Star, had lost touch with many community issues, housing and social development, and I think this has been important.
I kind of view the way the media has developed in this part of Canada, and I can also see it in lots of other areas that Brenda and I both have worked. The news editor sits in his office at the daily press or at the radio or TV station, and he waits for the phone to ring if somebody calls a press conference, and he goes and covers the press conference. He reports what the guy says. It's forgotten. It's gone. He never checks back again to see, you know, really whether the government ever followed up on that program, whether they did it. So the public just doesn't have any idea on how things develop and how things progress.
The position of the so-called alternate media, first of all, isn't a position. They don't have a position, really. There's nothing more painful than to look at some examples of the alternate press and you know, find yourself twitching after the second paragraph because they've obviously got so many things wrong. Let me give you just one little story about that. Keith Davey was having hearings, and he invited the underground press, so-called, up to the House to attend his committee, you know, although how an underground press can turn up like that, you know, it really means you have to redefine underground, you know. Can't imagine Lenin turning up with Iskra, you know. But they turned up there, and Davey obviously was keen to have a national underground press, if you like. Now, he said to one of the guys, I think it was in the Georgia Strait, he said, "Do you have a national press advertising manager?" And the guy said, "Sure, yeah, we have, yeah." So Davey said, "Now, where is he located?" And he said, "I think he's in Pennsylvania." Yeah. Davey nearly flipped, you know. And this kind of thing goes on all the time. But apart from all that and all the things that are wrong with the alternative press, I think it is a tremendous development. it represents a growing dissatisfaction quite clearly among a number of articulate and informed people that the position is desperate. It also reflects the fact that there is the need among a number of people to have access to different kinds of information and information put in a different kind of way. One of the dangers that I see in the alternative press is that they will not be so much an alternative press as that they might become a parallel press. In other words, they might commit the same sins but in a more hip way, you know. And this is, it seems to me, to be a profound danger that some of the alternative press, has already fallen into this. The other thing about the alternative press, before we all start congratulating it and applauding, we should remember that the alternative press right now, it seems to me to be in the position of the black man in the South, you know, because the whites, you know, used to say, listen, I don't mind how close they get as long as they don't get too big. And this is what happens. As long as those papers, like The Last Post and so on, keep small, as long as they keep under 30,000 circulation, and above all, as long as they don't become competitors for the advertising that's going around, then everybody applauds them. I mean, my God, you know, the Financial Post writes glowing references for The Last Post. You know, now if that's not co-option a la Marcuse, I don't know what is. You know, this kind of thing, because they're not really a danger.
And what is happening is that these underground papers are introducing new concepts of journalism. It's really not. Some of them are not new concepts. Some of them are very old concepts. Really, this idea that a newspaper should be a means of communication within a community, and some of these underground papers are forcing the establishment papers to re-examine the way they have been performing their jobs, and see if there are some things in the underground press that they should be including in their own papers. Sometimes it's possible for a newspaper to get away from its readers sufficiently to create some sort of a gap. And what the underground press is pointing out in some respects is where this gap is, and sort of pointing the way for the establishment press to fill those gaps with the things suggested in the underground press. In other words, they're not really competing with the establishment press. They are supplementing it. What Guerrilla is not competition for the Toronto Star. It's something that would probably make a nice occasional supplement to the Toronto Star. It's something strange, something different, contains material that the Star, as I said, hasn't room to print or hasn't the inclination to print because it deals with things which are not of a wide enough interest. Now, these things... again, this is the service function of a newspaper. Some people feel that the service is not being properly performed by the daily press. I think the daily press is performing it within its own limitations. In other words, the Toronto Star, for example, has to think about its 400,000 readers every day and 500,000 on Saturday. It really can't afford, if it's to be fair to the majority of its readers, to go out on a limb and put out a newspaper that would really please 10,000 young people, or even 50,000 young people. It has to have material that is of wide enough appeal to most of its readers to not to turn them off. But The Last Post, which is quite different, and I wouldn't call it an underground paper. I would call The Last Post a political magazine. Now, it is quite different, and of course, it is providing an alternative to Time magazine, which is the only other so-called Canadian periodical. Now, The Last Post, I think, is filling a very useful function in writing long, well-researched, in-depth articles about matters of concern to Canadians, which they cannot get anywhere else, because they establishment press is either not interested or hasn't got I shouldn't say facilities, because they have the facilities, the inclination, I suppose, to go into involved, the kind of involved, time-consuming research that The Last Post seems to be doing for its articles.
Perhaps to a certain extent, you will find some changes in the establishment press. It's quite possible that an issue will be written up in the last post, that the establishment press is ignored, and that then the establishment press may handle it, although probably they won't handle it in the same way that we did. But if you're thinking in terms of the establishment press moving so far left that it makes an establishment media unnecessary, I think, no, that's simply impossible. It's not going to happen. Because the establishment press reflects and is controlled by and is owned by a whole series of establishment institutions, whether you think in terms of the relationship to political parties or whether they're relationships to corporations, the relationships to advertisers, or their commitment to a certain philosophy, a certain political philosophy. No, they just can't change, not that much. Example of this, perhaps, would be the Montreal Star, which during the past few years has tried to become an increasingly active liberal paper. I mean, really liberal, and trying to get all sorts of issues and articles and so on into the paper that they would not have printed, say, 4 or 5 years ago. And to a considerable extent, they've done this. But nevertheless, when it came down to a couple of issues that were very close at home, such as the passage of the anti-demonstration bylaw here in Montreal, and also the question of the Parti Québécois during the last Quebec provincial election, the Montreal Star showed that, at least on its editorial page, it had not changed at all.
We're being fed pap and bullshit through the bourgeois media. We're being fed a lifestyle that's obsolete, and the perspective that encourages that lifestyle is sick. The perspective that encourages the kind of bourgeois hegemony in North America, that, you know, the white skin privilege and the liberal guilt conscience about the war in Vietnam and stuff. Well, that same perspective that lays these guilt trips on, and the same perspective that rationalizes the necessity for killing people in Asia so that we can have better toothpaste, is sick, you know. And we've got to be able to analyze the actual political situation, the actual social situations, from a standpoint, from a perspective that sees that kind of bullshit for what it is.
Breakfast where the news is read, television, children fed, unborn living, living dead. Bullet strikes the helmet's head, and it's all
Vancouver's Yellow Journal is distinctive in both attitude and style. It was a movement paper. It related to the people on the street, but it had its own decided political aims and defined, although not always consistent, strategy. It was much heavier and more radical politically than most of the underground. If I seem to be speaking of it as though it were defunct, it's because it is presently in the process of transition, as Rick Monahan explains.
The Yellow Journal, as it existed, is no longer in existence. The Yellow Journal, as it existed, was very hasty coalition between some people from the Vancouver Liberation Front and other sort of yippie aligned people that the coalition started on the assumption that like political objectives meant like political strategy, which didn't work out. So the object was to get a newspaper going which would give a radical perspective on the labor scene, student scene, street scene in Vancouver. You see, we're talking about a non-entity now. We're talking about a Yellow Journal that's in transition. from being that uneasy coalition. Into what is probably best described now as an independent left journal that's being that's going to be put out by the independent left community. The independent left community is by and large heavily individualistic and inherently chauvinistic, the kind of anarchist left that's been doing a lot of good political education, you know, for years, not just over the past few months. The Yellow Journal is going to come out as a independent left newspaper. The people in VLF that were connected with the Yellow Journal are going to be working more in educational pamphlets and educational broadsheets that won't be newsy, you know, topical newsy, but will be able to be used and reused and reused. Stuff on the structure of the legal system, stuff on the structure of municipal, provincial, federal government, stuff on the international structure of imperial monopolies, basic pamphlets on stuff like women's rights, basic pamphlets on medical, legal, that sort of information that we aren't taught, we're expected to acquire somehow, but we're never taught. We're taught how to use certain systems through experience. We're taught how to use the courts through experience, but we don't know what the actual social function of the courts is. And that's the sort of thing that the VLF pamphlets will be getting into. But that's only one aspect of what VLF is into, and that's only one of the projects. It's called Agitprop, standard. Agitation propaganda.
If Yellow Journal is an extension of the journalistic endeavors of the independent left, the last Post, a national political magazine, harks back to an even older tradition, that of the muckraker. It has long been a basic tenet of journalism that well-researched examinations of basic issues are a newspaper's real contribution to the political process. Sadly, that tradition has just about disappeared in the Canadian press. The big dailies do not seem to have the inclination to revive it, but the last Post does, and has earned wide respect and admiration for filling the gap. We spoke with Peter Allnut and Drummond Burgess in Montreal about their political role.
The most immediate gap is one of reporting on the activities of large corporations. If you take the example of Eaton's, which buys ads in every large newspaper across the country, you'll find that very few of the decisions of Eaton's, of the activities, both within itself and the effect that it's had on large cities, especially the downtown development of, let's say, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, you'll find that people just can't find out about these things, and it's just a basic failure of journalism. Reporters are not telling what is going on, and most of them realize that those things should be written, and many of them actually try to write them, and they can't. This example carries over into the activities of many of the large corporations, especially the ones which have an immediate effect on the policy of the federal government in things such as development of the North, foreign policy, grants that are given to industrial development. That's one level, and that's just a question of big business controlling big newspapers. The other gap is one which is more insidious, which arises out of the tremendous amount of influence of the American media. And that is one in which few Canadians can actually develop a distinct national culture which will enable them to preserve what amount of identity there is to Canada, and therefore preserve its resources, and therefore allow it to grow. Actually, I think it's incredible that something like The Last Post exists, really. That it is such a outside of the normal activity of Canadian way of life phenomena. It seems to me that the kind of content that's in The Last Post, the kind of thing that it's trying to do, should be in every newspaper and every magazine in the country, and even beyond that. If you look at the need for an alternative media in Canada, you get down to two basic kinds of newspapers. One is the regional paper or the community paper, which is set up, grows out of a certain community with certain economic needs, let's say, or certain economic dependencies on the rest of the country. And there you've got the example of the Prairie Fire in Regina, where it's obviously serving the people of Regina, and it's obviously part of the prairie economic structure. At the same time, you have the need for something which is national, but I think anyway recognizes the fact that Canada is made up of several economic regions. And that's not just a question of saying that we've got a geographical unit in BC and another one in the Maritimes and it's expensive to talk on the telephone back and forth, but it's to say that in terms of our relations to the United States, that the investment that comes in, the raw materials which go out, the amount of control that's exercised is done through a series of relations with independent provincial governments which compete against each other. And so there's a completely different set of needs, a completely different set of grievances, if you want, in each area. And one newspaper or magazine can't possibly do that right across the board. Each region needs its own alternative media to attack its own leaders that are doing that in those areas and to try and build up some, or become part of some local movement which is trying to seize back control. But at the same time, I think you need a national alternative media, which is telling each of those groups about each other, which is comparing the various economic regions that you have and how they can possibly coexist in such a manner that one is not exploiting the other. It's not part of a counterculture in the sense that a lot of underground newspapers see themselves in the sense of wearing your hair differently, listening to different music, never talking with people who don't look like you. Or don't use the same language as yourself. Like, I think that's been, to a large extent, a failure. Although there's a lot to be learned out of that again. It's part of a different form of culture in the sense that we want to do, by example and working with people who will say, this is the area that I'm working in, this is my trade, this is what I'm doing, and we're going to make available to ourselves the means to control it.
If you're taking underground press to mean strictly a sort of cultural revolution thing, the, I don't know, the hippie-type papers, whatever you want to call it, then that's not where we're at. That's not what we're interested in. But if you're taking some of the smaller papers, such as the Prairie Fire or a magazine in the Maritimes, the Mysterious East, that are political in their orientation, that in many ways are doing the same thing that we are doing, only either on a smaller community level or on a regional basis, then we certainly feel we're part of the same thing that they are.
And that so-called underground press, the hippie press if you want, has changed significantly over the past year, in the sense that those people are becoming aware that it requires political organization and it requires uniting with other groups who don't think the same way themselves on everything in order to get the kind of changes that they're after, that you can't set up your own little mini-culture within a large city and hope that it's going to flourish. You have to go out and knock certain things down before you can start building up the kind of society that you want.
As Peter says, I think this is changing. A number of so-called hippie papers are becoming quite political. Octopus in Ottawa, for example.
And of course, one can't underestimate the value of these papers in the sense that they have been around, they have been struggling in their own way, and just because we don't agree with them totally doesn't mean that we can write them off as being, you know, like we're the saviors and all that sort of thing. Because for some time they were the only ones that, you know, had the gall to go outside the established media and try it.
I personally find it hard to doubt the need for change in the Canadian media, but the prospect of change is not good. As Patrick McFadden of The Last Post in Ottawa put it, there's a lot of despair going around among journalists. For all the faults of the underground press, it really lets you know what you've been missing. It is still a peripheral phenomenon, but its market is growing. What is most encouraging is the way in which the underground is run. Collectives of people sharing the wealth in order to survive and publish. Former professionals operating like a small business, certainly in financial trouble, but still without the fixation on making a profit that motivates a large corporation like a Metropolitan Daily. What is not encouraging is the political climate. It is a situation that gives Time and Reader's Digest tax exemptions for being Canadian, and Logos and Harbinger massive fines for indelicate social comment. It's not hard to see that an underground paper will have trouble just surviving. They may get respect, but that's not the same as money in the bank. This isn't entirely bad, for as Henry Milner of Octopus remarked, you've got to be continually struggling in order to do it right. But on the other hand, that struggle takes time and energy, and when the returns are small, it's hard for any writer to see the underground as a permanent way of life. Newspapers are important. They define the community to itself. The alternative press is the only medium that is close enough to the street to make that definition honest. Virtually all underground papers are making a real effort to relate to the broadest constituency they can, through culture or politics. But if they are to be more than a fringe, they're going to need all the support that constituency can give them.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Man, the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News. Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.
That was freelance broadcaster David Keeble presenting his view of the underground press. Paul Andre and Deborah Shabrack helped conceive the program, and thanks go to Kim Whale in Vancouver and Marvin Burke in Halifax for their interviews. Tomorrow night at the same time, Ideas presents the second of the Massey Lectures, the CBC's most prestigious series of talks. The Nobel Prize-winning scientist George Wald is this year's lecturer. He will speak tomorrow on the origins of life. If you're interested in obtaining an advanced schedule of Ideas programs, please write to Ideas, Post Office Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto. That's Ideas, Box 500, Terminal A, Toronto. We're always happy to have your comments and suggestions. Ideas was produced tonight by Lewis Auerbach, and David McPherson is in charge of our series on politics and the imagination. I'm Jim Robertson. Good night.
Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land. You know, John Paul Getty is just plain folks. The UN Charter is a cruel hoax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. J. Edgar Hoover is the man of the hour. All that he needed is a little more power. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. Seven little pennies in the newsboy's hand, and you ride right along to Never Never Land.